Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the Department of Business Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is the first part of episode 35, where we are discussing Arlie Russell Hochschild's work, The Managed Heart. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Ralph Soule coming to you from Great Falls, Montana, in the middle of a snowstorm that did not get in the way of my recording.
This is Tom Galvin calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Ella coming to you from Sydney in Australia.
Today we're talking about The Managed Heart, and we're going to refer to the author throughout the episodes as Arlie, because the last name is a bit of a tongue twister for at least me, and we want to be consistent on the way we pronounce the name. So no disrespect intended to the author. The book is actually separated into two parts. In part one, the author describes the workings of an emotional system in the normal private lives people have. And in part two, she tries to show what happens when this gift of emotional expressiveness and emotional systems becomes a commodity, and that commodity is a feeling people need to produce. The work focuses on, in the details of this commoditization of feeling, she uses two main examples, which are based on case study research that she had done. First is airline flight attendants. That's what we call them now. They used to be called stewardesses. So she was largely focusing on female flight attendants. And then the second part, she talks about bill collectors. And I think I have that right. So people who are collecting for bad credit, essentially. And it's interesting that she juxtaposes the two occupations, one in the time that she was writing, and I think largely still so today. So the book was issued in 1983 and has been reissued a second edition in 2012. The flight attendants were largely almost entirely female. Now it's largely female, but not entirely. And then she was looking at the debt collectors as a profession, and that was largely male as well.
The thing that I find fascinating is not just that the flight attendants were female and the bill collectors were male, but that the emotions that were being commercialized in both occupations are so very, very different, and yet the process of commercialization appeared to be the same. I also was very struck by a third example that she gives very, very early in the book, and I happen to have a 7-year-old son. And for anybody reading the book for the first time, if you can get through the first couple of pages thinking about the plight of a 7-year-old working in a British wallpaper factory during the Industrial Revolution, that definitely will get your attention as to what we were talking about in terms of the labor. And so to show that there's commonality between what was a very abusive environment with what kind of systems were in place being imposed upon flight attendants in the present day is very interesting. And I think added a lot of punch to the work. So I'd be very excited to get into that a little bit more.
Yes. And in fact, that description, it was a mother of a 7-year-old working in the wallpaper factory, was just, I thought it was chilling. It's sort of what was taken for granted or what was common back in the day. But obviously, we've changed a lot in our perspectives about child labor and that sort of thing. But it was, did get my attention. She also has, later in the book, she talks a lot about parenting and the shaping of emotions and feelings through parenting, which having been a parent myself, I also found it hit pretty close to home.
Yeah, this sort of building on the idea of physical labor in the Industrial Revolution, and then taking that analogy and looking at what that looks like when we think about emotional labor, which was this term that she introduced, is just so powerful, because we know about a lot of the hardship of physical labor and what that looks like, but we haven't, until this work, which was really important when it came out, we haven't thought a lot about all the work that goes into controlling emotion, regulating emotion, acting in the workplace. And one of the sort of sad things about it that I found is that there's not even a premium put on that kind of emotional labor. There's not a great amount of pay in it for these flight attendants. Sure, it's seen as good work at the time, but it's not paid highly the way that some other kind of work might be done, like sort of more the IQ work. This is more the EQ work. And so that concept.
Oh, that's a great way to say it.
Yeah, and that concept of emotional labor didn't really exist until she drew attention to it. And now we understand that this work still goes on today.
Yeah, and she particularly, if you think about it, she later we'll talk about this, but she talks about deep acting and how it's considered honorable for actors, but it hasn't really translated, not only honorable, but even admirable for actors. And yet, I think what's really interesting, I'll let you brought that out, that it's not considered in the light that she discusses it in the book, particularly noteworthy or special, given the fact that it has this tremendous emotional content to the job. And it's a lot of work. They talk about flight attendants psyching themselves up for the work and this the mental images they have to convey. So that's a great observation that despite this energy and effort that goes into that, they're not particularly well paid for that kind of effort. So that's a great observation.
I think what we probably could do is spend a moment to talk about what she means by emotional labor and then come around to talking about what she meant by the deep acting versus the more, I believe it was shallow acting.
The surface acting, yeah.
Surface acting.
Surface acting, yes, you're right. So okay. With the concept of emotional labor, as I took it from the book, is that the commercialization of it is kind of the focus of the book. But it's basically the expectation that when you are showing feelings or showing emotions on the job, it is in the context of working with the public. And the feelings in which you convey are a commodity that represents the projected image of the company. And so the flight attendants, now we almost caricaturize it now with the, you know, the waving at the, as you exit the airplane, the bye-bye and that sort of thing. But in a real sense, especially in the time in which she conducted the study, the flight attendants had to show deep concern, interest, and a positive attitude, regardless of what was going on stressful internally to the flight attendants. They had to show this, let's call it a facade. I'm not sure that's the right term, but a presentation that everything was, you know, everything was okay, that the passengers were the most important people on the airplane, that their every need was going to be taken care of, et cetera, et cetera. And the purpose for the commercialization was to get them to fly the airline again. If they were happy with the service, if they were happy with the way they were treated by the flight attendants, that would translate to more ticket sales. And so then in order to do that, then we have this concept of surface and deep acting that she brings up that are like different layers of how the flight attendants assume the role and suppress their own personal emotions, because obviously being a flight attendant can be stressful, especially if you're in a turbulent flight path. They can't show that emotion. So
one thing I wanted to just extend a little bit further was this difference between surface acting and deep acting. The surface acting, as she explains it, and she explains it through the context of actual actors and acting. And there's a famous actor, director, whose name I can't pronounce, is mentioned in the book. But that's not what's really important. And this was a director who is well known for developing what's called method acting. But he and the author say that surface acting is just the appearance of joy or happiness or being glad to see somebody. So you're modifying your facial muscles, you're smiling, you might be looking at them in a certain way. So it's basically it's a physical representation of the attitude or the stance that you're taking. And deep acting is actually more of becoming the role. And in the case of acting, it's and you're trying to show happiness or joy. You try to imagine the happiest time you've ever had in your life. And that is what animates your approach. And you are actually physically do become happy, or internally you become happy. And that's what you're conveying. And it's a much deeper feeling. So the flight attendants at Delta, who she was able to observe their training and their refresher training, they were told to imagine you were inviting passengers into your living room and you were treating them as honored guests in your living room as opposed to just smile a lot. And I think that's a reasonable description that certainly opened my eyes about that difference of how you can go from the surface acting to deep acting. And one thing I want to talk about this, she talks about emotional work, right? Ella was mentioning that, and she actually introduced the term. And it's got these three features that are discussed in chapter one, where it's basically labor in that it's the work that you do that your job requires you to be engaged in emotional work. And she talks about that weaves itself. She weaves that many times in and out of the arguments that she makes in the book. Then there's this display of feeling discourse, this idea that you have to actually display that feeling. And then it's the managing of emotions is that third discourse, which I thought was really interesting because I never really thought of it that way. I mean, I've been on plane flight before, and I've also – you also see people who are in customer service. And until I read this book, I took it for granted that not just that it was their job to be nice, not really, but you know that was built into the job. I never really thought about these extra dimensions to
that. I think that there was a really nice quote in the book where it's referencing one of the airline slogans, and it says, "Where our smiles are not just painted on." And I think that that sets up that distinction between surface acting and deep acting really nicely, because you can paint on a smile, service with a smile, but everyone knows that that's fake and that's fine. But this era where being happy is part of your role and actually showing that sincerity of emotion as a way to make your customers feel happy and like you're giving them that authentic smile, for that to be a part of your work, that's a big ask. So this is sort of the company is not just asking you to act, they're asking you to feel. And that's where that real commercialization of human feeling comes in. It's sort of going a bit further, I thought, than what might be okay or might be expected.
Absolutely.
And it's also striking the degree to which the lengths to which that the company imposed this idea of the ideal customer service on the flight attendants into the training, into their not just their entry-level training, but also in their sustainment training. It was just imbued throughout. And the problems that it caused with, the stress that it created over time for some of the flight attendants. Yeah. I mean, we can kind of understand that. You can mask your emotions for a period of time until it just, it bubbles up and it breaks out into, something else where they start to rebel or they feel like they can't contain it anymore. And the company figured out that that was going to be the case. And so they put in all these checks and balances to try to give the flight attendants some outlets to work on that so that they can get past any off feelings they were having and get back to the desired emotion.
Yeah, that was never about the customers being at fault. So these flight attendants were getting abused all the time and harassed. I mean, it was pretty nasty, some of the stuff that was directed towards them. But the way that the company trained them was to never think of it in terms of the customer doing something wrong. It was always an issue of managing their own emotions. I found that really fascinating.
Right. So I was going to say the same thing, that they essentially delegitimized the flight attendants' emotional response to getting abused. Basically, your reaction isn't legitimate. And as Ella said, it's not quite there's never wrong, but there's a version of that they say.
The customer isn't always right, but they're never wrong.
Yeah, there we go. That's the best way. Yes. And so they actually depersonalize it. They refer to these abusive or disrespectful customers as irates, and the flight attendants were encouraged to maybe even disembody them and say, well, this isn't a real person. It's a frightened child, or it's somebody who is in this difficult situation, and they don't know how to act any better, or this incivility is not something that you should attribute to them. And I just thought that was amazing, that the way their training encouraged them to not see their what I would consider a normal reaction, encouraged them not to see that as legitimate.
Absolutely, and then that leads to this interesting word of estrangement, which Ellie's borrowing from Braverman, who wrote about the physical labor process and what that does to our connections to our body. And so then sort of transposing that concept into the emotional space, we can get estranged from our feelings to the point where one of the negative consequences can be that you're not trusting your own feelings and you end up not feeling anything if you do this too much.
Yeah, they were talking about it produces deadness in people, which I just thought was scary. In chapter one, Ehrlich uses the expression, this transmutation of an emotional system, which I thought was really interesting. It was a little hard for me to grasp when I first see it, but then as you see it work its way through the other chapters, it comes a little bit more clear. But this whole idea that you're converting what is essentially a personal, most of us think it was a personal and private response to stimuli, and maybe something you're not even always conscious about, but moving these into things that's large organizations and supervisors try to manage and control in the pursuit of company goals. I thought that was a really interesting way to look at it.
bringing in the other example that she raised with the tax collectors, there's a very interesting opposite case where you move from the customer is always right to the customer is always wrong, and the oppositeness of the feelings in which they're expected to display as they treat every single you can't really call them customer. I mean, they're basically a target.
Yeah.
They are a deadbeat. They are looked upon as a deadbeat. There's the absolute epitome of dehumanization, that anything that they must have done is wrong. They are a liar. They're a cheat. They're phony, whatever, in order to dehumanize the target and to get them to cough up the money or at least enter into some sort of an agreement. And so the emotional labor takes on a wholly opposite character, in which the emotions you are expected to show are aggression, distrust, a lot of negative emotions directed.
Yeah.
Dominance, absolutely, directed at the target.
Another feature of that, in addition to this opposite, sort of this opposite lens or opposite end of the spectrum, whatever you want to say, was that unlike flight attendants, whose essentially emotional work is towards building up the esteem of the clients and supporting them and making them feel comfortable, in the case of the debt collectors, it's exactly the opposite. The techniques they were teaching were designed to break them down as perhaps proud individuals or people who had some self-esteem, break down their self-esteem, because apparently the management thinks that's a better way to get them to contribute to paying their bills.
It was kind of a nice strategy the way that she used Delta's flight attendants and then Delta's bill collectors to kind of create some symmetry in the analysis. But I saw these two examples as playing out quite differently. One is this constant suppression of a natural reaction towards people who are not treating you very well, in the case of the flight attendants. And the other, with the bill collectors, she's saying that people who take on this work actually quite like getting upset at people and belittling them. So this is almost a release for them. There were examples of people who didn't like deflating the people that they had to call, but it seemed to me that this was actually quite different kind of emotional work. What did you both think? Did you see these examples as just equivalent but the opposite, or what did you think?
I don't know. I saw it just the way you saw it, Ella, where it was – it's almost like the evil twin of the – and it's essentially working for the same company, but this is a dark side of emotions. I think Tom was talking about that. So I thought it was a really interesting contrast. I had read before about how being a debt collector and can be damaging emotionally and quite a bit on your psyche. I just didn't realize that doing the more friendly stuff like being a flight attendant could also be similarly damaging. So it's really interesting, even though the nuts and – bolts of the interaction are vastly different, it still has a roughly similar cost on them emotionally. That's what I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, the nature of the emotional labor in terms of what it's about and how it's built up or how it's cultivated is very similar between the two. The difference is in the character of it. So it's in the case of the flight attendants, I think one thing that wasn't specifically brought out in the reading, but I think it could be inferred, is that this is the friendly face that's intended to be presented to the masses, the mass of customers, whereas the debt collectors, their emotions are specifically directed at individuals. And it's individuals, a select set of individuals. And my interpretation of the way in which she describes it is that it's intended not to be seen by anybody outside of those individuals. I mean, the targets, nobody else is supposed to know about this debt collector treatment except for unless you happen to be in debt yourself. They want the friendly visage to be the one that's visible to the masses.
That's right, yeah.
Right, and that was it was embodied in one really concrete way, which was the flight attendants are encouraged to have name tags so that everybody can see so people can refer to them by name, whereas the debt collectors were encouraged to use pseudonyms because many were actually afraid that somebody would drive down to the whatever the facility, however they figured that out, and because maybe they actually had to get sent to go to the building to deliver the money. I don't really know, but they were worried about exposing themselves to potential physical harm or harassment. In chapter two, she basically goes into details of where feelings or what feelings are, and because many of us think of those as just a feeling based directly in emotion or spontaneously emerging. And she introduces the notion that feelings can actually be managed, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I think it makes sense after you read it, but I don't believe I was aware of it until I read it.
Yeah, that was interesting because this is pointing out that even in our private lives, we are managing, regulating emotions all the time, and this is towards some kind of cultural norm. So how upset should you be at a funeral? There's all of these rules around that depending on how well you knew the person and that that's the right time to grieve. And so she explains that we're doing this quite naturally all the time.
Oh, yeah, that's excellent because she has many statements from people she interviewed about times when they felt they didn't exhibit the correct emotion or what they perceived others expected them to feel. So there's this whole idea she talks about in the chapter of how these expectations are created in people and the dissonance it causes for them, almost like cognitive dissonance, where people can't bring themselves to feel a particular way, and therefore they often fake it to make others around them feel better or to not to have people think they're weird because they can't feel grief at somebody's funeral because they didn't know Uncle So-and-so.
Yeah, that's right. And then they might draw on a memory of when they did feel sad to produce the emotions that they feel are expected of them.
And also to address those cases where they actually legitimately felt the opposite of what would be expected. So, for example, if you had a relative who passed away, that your feeling may be of relief as opposed to sadness. Like, thank heaven that he's passed away after this long illness. Or in the more unfortunate cases where you're happy the person is gone because they were abusive or what have you. And so then, you know, that's definitely cases where the natural reaction is one of the opposite of what would ordinarily might be expected at such events. And that's where a lot of the surface acting can kind of come in, where you mask or you withhold or hide the true feelings in order to just divert attention away from yourself.
Yeah, she's got this really interesting quote up 29 where she talks about feeling as they spontaneously emerge. She says it acts for better or worse as a clue that, you know, you've either been injured or emotionally injured or insulted or complimented or enhanced. I thought that was really interesting because I'd never actually thought of a feeling as something like that where it's a clue for what's going on in your life.
Well, it sounds so self-evident.
Yeah, exactly, right? So some of this stuff, I mean, I thought it was almost philosophical in many ways, which I think, and I mean that in a good way, where it made me think about, so that's what's going on. And when I was being educated by my parents about how I should respond to somebody or, you know, what was the appropriate response, and that comes later in the book, but she talks about how these things come up. And there's another really great quote on page 30 where she says, a person totally without emotion has no warning system, no guidelines to the self-relevance of a slight, a memory, or a fantasy.
Oh, I love that. That was she drew the analogy to if you can't feel pain physically, you know, like you don't know that you're burning yourself if you touch a hot stove, that can be really right. Difficult for people to live with that condition. And she's equating that to an emotional lack of emotional response can also lead you astray.
Yeah. And so it's sort of make me wonder if those people that you see kind of constantly blundering into difficult situations or maybe less empathetic than the others, it's almost like they don't feel the pain the same way. And some of that empathy is similar. It just gave me a chance to think about that. I don't know. I wasn't trying to do too much psychoanalysis there, although she brings in lots of Freud and, you know, deep psychoanalysis kind of stuff. But it made me think a lot deeper about that than I think I normally would have. And I think this relates to this estrangement that you were talking about earlier, Ella, where she says, we need feeling in order to reflect on the external or objective world. And that's on page 31. So I thought, wow, that is really something because it gives you this sense of where you are and how you relate to the rest of the world.
That's quite radical coming from a research perspective as well, because we've been taught that the best way to access the empirical world is to be objective. And that means to suppress any kind of emotion, bias, feeling, the ultimate researcher is this complete automaton. But she's saying, no, actually, emotion and feeling is part of what gives us understanding about the world, intuition that we require to get at meaning. So this is quite radical from that perspective as well.
Well, that's a great point because I've always felt inadequate because I couldn't be the automaton. So, I try to be objective, but I recognize I'm not a robot. So that's, you know, I'm not going to be able to get very far. So thanks for giving me that permission.
No worries.
We kind of spread across both chapters 2 and 4, as a matter of fact, because not just with the feeling cues, she also talked about the feeling rules. And that was where my example of the funeral came up. Let's move over to chapter 5 about how we, you know, she called it paying respects with feeling. It's in effect using cues and rules to exchange feelings or to convey feelings for a purpose, to accomplish something.
She talks about it as like a gift exchange, right? It's a wonderful metaphor because it's almost a transactional. So it's not just a gift exchange. It is an exchange. It's almost this transactional system. And she talks about how people will be offended or frustrated because you don't respond. They sense that you don't respond the way they expect you to. And I've actually had the case where I'm not responding the way people expect me to. And they will tell me essentially as if they could read my mind, oh, you really do feel this way. And so I don't argue with them because I think, okay, well, I see you have that view. But it actually frustrates them because I don't respond the way they would have expected me to.
Yeah. Let me just kind of give a couple of passages from page 78. When a giver and a receiver share an expectation about how much sincerity is owed, and sincerity being owed is an interesting idea in itself. Gestures can be judged as paying less or more than what is owed. So that's when the receiver of a favor responds less generously than expected. The giver might openly say, so that's all the thanks I get. And that sort of exchange is one that I've certainly run into in my, you know, family life. That was actually the lens that I was reading through as I was reading that particular chapter.
Right.
But it also, you know, in a work environment, you can kind of see the same sort of actions at play just naturally where you're very excited about something that you have accomplished. You're not getting the same sort of feeling in return. You don't get the same level of gratitude from your boss. And then you start questioning yourself. Uh-oh, did I do the wrong thing?
Yeah, that's a great example. Because many times I have had that sort of experience where it's almost, so that's the thanks I get. And I start thinking to myself, so who has the issue here? Is it me because I'm not satisfied with their response? Am I the one who's having a problem? Or is it because they're not indicating, you know, I have this sort of floor of gratitude response and they're not exceeding it? You know, so that would say, okay, they're the ones at fault. But lately, and this even before I read this, but it just made me think deeper about this. It's really it might say actually more about you. In fact, I was in a restaurant where I guess stand behind the cash register or at the bar or someplace, and you could see a little bit into the back room, and they had a poster up that said, "When you talk," and it had a vulgar word, I think there, you know, X to a customer, it says more about you than it does about them. That was sort of the attitude in the restaurant. But I just think that's a very interesting way. You can actually look at it from two ways.
Yeah, I mean, it gets complicated then because if someone has not shown you gratitude, you've gone out of your way to do something for them, and they're not showing you gratitude, you feel upset. Is the appropriate response to go, I'm getting the wrong feeling, I should feel differently? You know, that's sort of what Ellie's getting at later on, is that we then manage our own emotions. Or do we say, hey, you're being ungrateful, yes, I just did this thing for you, I expect more.
There really is no right answer, right? And oftentimes it depends on how well you know the person and kind of relationship that you have, and is it transitory? Do you know? Do you have time to have that conversation with somebody? So I just think this whole idea of making that in many situations unconscious, making it more visible. I love the way she made that clear.
I think that's a huge feature of this book. Previously weren't visible. These things are going on all the time. We don't put words to them. We don't name them. We don't call them out. And she puts a spotlight on all this kind of work.
And then when you move into part two, which is when we get it back into the commercialization side, and now you start to see how the private system, the private emotional system, collides with the public emotional system that's being imposed upon by the company. And you can see where the stressors come in, where if you spend your life, your young life, feeling and cueing, following certain rules, exchanging a certain way, and then you join a firm that requires you to work with customers and they expect you to behave a certain way. Now you can see where conflict will come in. Some rules, some cues you may be comfortable with, but others you may not be. And it can create stress. It can create all the problems we've talked about.
Right. And she puts it in she has many contexts, but one of them is about power relations, right? Where I think some aspects of modern work have become more egalitarian. There's a lot of, she gives a lot of descriptions in there of things that the flight attendants were subjected to that are just be horrifying and not, you know, you wouldn't be able to do now. But I think this idea of the power dynamic is still really important. This idea that somebody can tell you how you're supposed to feel. I thought that was really an important idea in the part two of the book, what that causes for people.
Absolutely. That's so powerful to think about the company encroaching in this very private sphere of the employee's life and requiring certain things from them. And not only that, profiting from people's emotions and their management of their own emotions. It's pretty profound. But I'm not sure that it is so different today. I've worked in retail for many years before getting into academic work, and it's a different world. And definitely in terms of customers feeling like they can treat you any way they want, that's not really changed. And some companies do expect you to just put on a smile, deal with it, and then we'll want to know what you did wrong to make the customer act that way. So I think that this sort of encroachment and those sort of treatments are not necessarily that different.
You have a point in that these egalitarian workplaces I was imagining, like Zappos and some of those kind of things, they are not the norm. And I think that's a good point that you made, that it's, you don't want to get caught up in, okay, we like to feel better about work and we're empowering employees. Maybe that's a lot more talk than action.
Well, what she did do is she juxtaposed that after when the U.S. deregulated its airlines, it changed the type of customer which they received, and it also came in concert with the unionization of the flight attendants, where they changed a little bit in character. There was still the expectation that they would be friendly and would help customers, but the expectations of those particular flight attendants changed a little bit. But then when you look at foreign airlines, those like airlines that are still nationalized, they still behave or still put the same expectations on their flight crews as were placed upon flight attendants way back. And I see that in some of the airlines that I've flown, that it feels like, you know, the flight attendants are expected to behave differently in particular airlines based on the character of, or what type of an airline it is.
That's a great point, because she gives the example of Singapore Airlines. Mm-hmm. I think it's SAS now, but it used to be called Singapore Air International or something. Yeah. This whole idea of the Asian view of customer service and treatment, and I thought that was really interesting, that they're kind of a throwback, but that pressure that causes makes it extra difficult for the flight attendants.
There were two conditions which I thought were really relevant that she brought up that affected emotional labor. One was speeding up, which as you say, Tom, came from the deregulation of the airline industry, that they were expected to fly longer hours, deal with more customers, which was interestingly also matched with the unionization and some improvements in work. But that to me was fascinating. What happens to emotional labor when you have this speeding up of work that's familiar to a lot of industries, that the flight attendants just didn't have the time or the energy to give everyone a smile in the process of having to get everyone on board and hand out the lollies, and you know, there just wasn't any time for it. So I'm not sure if that released them from their emotional labor or what effect it had, but I thought that was probably quite relevant for work today.
It certainly burned them out faster. That was very evident in there, and I think that's in concert with my personal experience with any workplace that is experiencing that type of speed up, where they have emotional labor at work, where they're dealing with the public, that you get tired of it very quickly, you burn out, and you end up with higher turnover, and all sorts of other problems start creeping in.
Exactly. And that was the other point. She was talking about the precarity of the work and the effect that has on people's feelings, but also whether they can afford to not show emotional labor. So those two things, speeding up and precarity, seem to come up as themes that surely those two concepts are very relevant today as well.
So in the latter part of the book, she really introduces power dynamics and that influence on the nature of the work and emotional work in particular, and how difficult that makes it for the employees, particularly emphasizing the flight attendants and the stress it causes them, but also this idea sort of the delegitimization again. Now that you've seen, she's taken you through the personal emotion, now we're talking public, and now the control aspects of that, where it's difficult for people to have their own voice, and is their voice even legitimate? And she doesn't. There's no answers in this. The second part of the book is just this is a cost for people in this kind of work. And she does emphasize something I thought was really important, and that is that sort of the male and female differences in flight attendants. That's emphasized in the last chapter or so, where female flight attendants are not perceived as authority figures the same way that even junior male flight attendants are. And she gives some examples of those kinds of things, which we see in the military every now and then, where people will have difficulty taking orders from women, and those people are ushered to the exits pretty quickly. But you can't do that when these are service positions and you're trying to make the customers happy. And she actually gives lots of descriptions of these very interesting questions people ask. Like you were talking about these longer hours, and somebody they'll fly like 12-hour flight to Singapore, and then they'll say, "Oh, and are you going on to Bangkok?" As if, "Oh yeah, that was just you'll just keep going," and this kind of thing, and no understanding.
Yeah,
the nature of the work. I thought that was very interesting that she closes out the book on this aspect of the differences from men and women are treated in the power dynamics, and in fact that more women are in these kind of emotional work occupations. She estimated roughly 50% than men are. So I thought that was a very nice way to start out private, talk about public, and then talk about what the implications are for the broader labor force.
The big takeaway I had at the end of the book too was about the chapter she called The Search for Authenticity, that since in the time leading up to the publication of the book, there was starting to be a desire or a demand for spontaneous natural feeling, as she put it on page 190. That there was growing recognition in advance of her putting the label emotional labor on it, that there was a sense that this inauthentic type of displays of feeling that people were receiving in the form of service was somehow undesirable or unsatisfying, and they wanted to have real, true, authentic displays given to them. And I think that that's something that has become even more prevalent as time has gone on since this book, about how authenticity means something. And when we sense that something is inauthentic, we think lower of the service that's being provided.
You now even get courses where you can learn how to be authentic, and sort of the paradox of that doesn't seem to be lost on
you. I think it's a great observation, right? Because it's like it's a paradox, as you said, right? Because so somehow they're going to manufacture this authentic feeling, or it'll just overtake them, that there's not effort to me to asking for somebody to produce an authentic feeling. It's a paradox. So I thought that was a great choice of words, Ella.
I think there's a quote, it might have been from Zizek, and it says that, we've always been unhappy, but now we feel guilty for feeling unhappy. So there's this extra kind of layer that's been put on us, this expectation that we feel a certain way, that we act authentically in our work as well as in our personal lives, and it's almost like there's no space left to just be and just exist. And there's all these expectations we're constantly just striving to meet. It's quite exhausting, I think.
Yeah, it is actually. And so she was talking about people in the academic professions, women professors being treated differently, and assertiveness and all those kinds of things, which I've always felt was a amazing double standard. But it's interesting the way that gets culturally wired into people. So that's the other thing she talks about. And it wasn't just in the context of flight attendants, but this sort of cultural programming that goes on. I thought that was very enlightening.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's all for part one of episode 35. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website. Don't forget that we now have a newsletter that comes out the day after each episode and contains some bonus and unique content. You can subscribe to that using your email only on our website. Please join us next time as we discuss part two of Arlie Russell Hochschild's The Managed Heart, here on Talking About Organizations.